Croeso. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the CC4 Museum of Welsh Cricket Podcasts. This week we bring you part two of my chat with Matthew Maynard. In this episode, Matt talks about captaincy, the dilemmas of selection, the 1997 championship winning season, his trip to Lords for the Benson Hedges Cup final, and his first steps in a coaching career. We hope you enjoy the listen.
What about captaincy, Matt? Had you had experience of captaincy in your younger days? And when and how did you kind of think about being a first-class captain for Glamorgan? And who influenced you with that idea and the idea of captaincy?
I've always thought about the game. People used to say I'm a student of the game. I don't watch the game. I study it. I can't watch a game of cricket and just kind of have it on in the background. If I watch it, I watch it and I study it and see movement patterns and et cetera, et cetera. I just can't help myself. So when Alan Butcher was captain, he actually made me vice captain. And in 92, he got injured. He suffered snapped his Achilles. So I was captain for a good number of games that year. And there was one in particular where we played Derby, the last game of the season, and it was one of those games that gets set up to an extent. They say they'd go for it if they're still in the game kind of thing. So I used kind of myself to throw some balls up to keep them in the strong. Crofty then to come in and take wickets, or Watty to come in. And we ended up winning this game of cricket. And I really enjoyed that, And but I don't know if I was ready at that stage for it, and that it was given to Hugh for the 93 season. I think that was, that was fair enough. And he was great planner, Hugh. Great systems that he had in place for the players that we had. Everyone knew their role within the team. Everyone was very clear on the objectives. So, Steve, for example, Steve and Adrian Dale, if they're batting together, you just run the opposition ragged, because they had a great understanding, I mean, some of the footage of... So I got sent a DVD of a NatWest game against Worcester, and it showed Steve James and Adrian Dale running between the wicket, and literally they were knocking it to gully and running and getting home easily. It was just an so that was there, but you run like crazy. And then myself and Viv had a little bit more of a free reign, to just play and react to where we are in the game without any, if I got tried to go over the top early on in my innings and got caught, there'd be nothing in the dressing room. Bad luck, Matt. It wouldn't be, what are you playing that shot for? It was a very supportive environment that Hugh had created. And that, I guess, alongside, just helped us to thrive, really, and helped me to thrive. So Hugh's vice captain. And then, obviously, he stood down after 96, 95. So he led 93, 94, 95. Took over then in 96. And, the big thing, we had a... a young West Indian overseas player, Otis Gibson, who was a fine cricketer, but he wasn't the finished article at that stage. So he was still young. And after Viv's influence, Otis didn't have the same influence as that. Obviously, he was a fine cricketer, but he didn't know his game as well, I think, at that stage. I mean, he went on to do unbelievable things at Durham. No, he had a fantastic career at Durham and Leicester as well, to be fair to him. And obviously coach now, is a wonderful top-level coach. But at that particular time, and there was a sniff that we could sign Waqar Yunus. And that was like almost like the final piece of the jigsaw, because we had a younger up-and-coming quick in Darren Thomas. We had a young spinner in Dean Kosker. We had experienced spinner in Crofty, experienced seamer in Steve Watkin. If we had Waqar as well, experienced, obviously lethal with a ball old or new. And then alongside someone like Daly, if the, so the balance of the side to try and play three three frontline seamers and two frontline spinners with Crofty batting at six or seven was really, really handy for us, you know. And that was the reason, really, that Metzen didn't. Well, there was a couple of reasons Metzen didn't play, but Adrian Shaw came in because he was a better batsman.
As a captain, you have to make decisions, and you've mentioned that kind of Shaw and Metzen kind of situation. Did you find it tough making decisions or defending decisions to people who always and inevitably criticize them?
Probably more so defending because they don't know the people involved. Like Shawsey was an unbelievable team man. You know, real, he'd do anything for his team. Colin was on his own. He was just selfish. He was working actually for a company alongside of his playing, a logistics company. Very bright lad and stuff like this, and an unbelievable keeper. You know, he was absolutely fantastic keeper. No doubt about it. And a big part of our 93 success was the way that he stood up to Roland Lefevre. You know, batters just couldn't get away. Because Roland was sharpish, you know, he'd hit the bat. But I remember Metten taking a stump and off the thigh pad down the leg side, and next minute the bails were off. Batsman just overbalanced a little bit. It was brilliant bit of work. I mean, it was a very, very good. If it's a from the outside world, why are you dropping this really, really good keeper in place of this bloke who's not as good a keeper? But he never stopped cheering the boys on, Shawsey. You know, contributed in the dressing room, kept the boys nice and relaxed, chilled, you know. So there are more components than just ability. I've always said that it's not, you have to be like, you have to be winning games. If you're a player who doesn't fit in very well to a dressing room, it's quite a, then you have to be exceptional. So you have to be winning games. It's very difficult for a wicketkeeper to win games. Very difficult. So if you're a spin bowler, but no, you can't bat, can't field, then you have to be taking like fifers to win games, sixers, sevenfers, to warrant that place. Otherwise, you're better off getting in someone who can take a fourfer, who can contribute a little 30 with a bat, who's good in the field and a great team person. So I've always kind of looked at it like that, because I've always been about team. The team's the most important thing, and that's the drive. If you get that team and the environment right within that team to allow players to play to their potential, then that's all you can do. That's the best you can do, I think.
Let's talk about 1997. You talk about Wacker coming into the side as being an important and vital piece of the jigsaw. Duncan Fletcher, how important was he to that success?
Very. I mean, we saw him. Steve James first mentioned Duncan Fletcher. He'd heard unbelievable things about him when Steve was in Zimbabwe, and Fletcher's name lived on in Zimbabwe when he'd moved down to Cape Town. You know, so they all talk about him in Harare and stuff like this, and Slam Fletcher, what a good captain he was, and brilliant coach, and all this kind of. So it kind of came up there, and then the year before he was. Head coach of the South Africa A side that came over. And although I didn't play in the game, I did watch. You got down to the ground early, watched how he prepared the players before start of play, but what he did after start of play as well. So the players who weren't playing in the game had to do, well, if batter didn't score any runs, they'd be working, they'd be doing a fielding fitness session. So that was good to see, and then got to talk to him briefly, and then yeah, then we got him along. So Fletch was a massive influence. The other massive influence that people don't kind of, well, there were two actually. Mike Fakin, his chief exec, was fantastic. And again, he whatever pressure that the committee would put on to us via him, if you like. He never passed that on to the players. So Mike was a big part. And Dean Conway, as physio, was unbelievable, played a massive part in that team environment, you know. Communicating if someone's just, because they all speak to the phys, don't they? You know, players on the bed and stuff like this having treatment, they'll speak to the phys. And if things, if someone was having a real tough time, Dino would just say, look, He wouldn't divulge. He'd keep things to himself. What was said privately, he would keep to himself. But you might just want to have a chat with Bob just to see everything's okay, you know, or whatever. And he'd put you in the right direction. So he was massive. But when Fletch just really fine-tuned, really, really fine-tuned. I mean, he didn't say much for the first couple of weeks. He was almost mute, just observing. But I'd sent him all footage. He'd asked for footage of players and my opinion on their strengths, weaknesses, etc. So I did that, sent that through. So I think he had an idea of the players, but then he obviously wanted to form his own ideas and stuff like this. But yeah, I thought he was, and his skill level at the, at running sessions, so precise. You know, when he was taking nicks, for example, he was brilliant. You know, it, so his because of his skill level was so high, he challenged us more in terms of the slips, how we were taking balls, because they weren't just all, you know, he was testing us left, right, and centre. So our slip fielding became better. Our keeping became better because he could, you know, he could nick through to the. We hadn't seen anyone nick into the keeper before. We didn't know that could be done. Keeper standing up, you know, for spinners, snick, snick, snick off the brilliant, you know. So his skill level at delivering fielding sessions and routine was out of this world. I still haven't seen someone who's as good as him. In all facets, whether that's hitting the high catches, you know, with right on the fence. So his influence there was brilliant. And he just said to me, just you worry about everything on field. I'll worry about everything off field. And he did. He took everything kind of away from me off the field. So there was no issue with anything. So he was massive. We'd have brilliant debates about the game, you know, about various things. And loved it, you know. We just love debating and challenging, I guess, each other.
In the foreword to your book, Duncan mentions the two innings during that 1997 season, right at the end, the one in the final game against Somerset, the 142, I think you got, and then he also mentions the one in the previous game against Essex, talked about them being two very contrasting innings that were perhaps a reflection of your maturity as a batsman. How did you see those two innings? Do you remember them both? I'm sure you remember the one at Taunton.
Yeah, the first one was against Essex. We were in the fourth innings of the game, and we needed 180 to win the game. We were 20 for two, and I got 70 odd not out. But it was a hard work wicket. You had to be smart. So it was about for me. It was about manipulating the spinner Peter Sutts that they had to for twos and stuff like that. You know. Because I couldn't, if you like, couldn't take him down because there was too much in the wicket for him. He was too good a bowler. So it was just about manipulating him, working him, getting him frustrated. And then if he did bowl a bad ball, then putting that away. But it wasn't actually looking to impose. It was about milking him. And I just think that came, a lot of that was down to Viv's influence. So I needed to be there at the death in that game. It was clear. And I needed to see us home, and I did. And it's however you just get the job done. And that was Viv's big influence on me, that, you know, shaking hands with the opposition and, you know, after that. But again, in that game, the game changer was, funnily enough, Ronnie Irani. So he was batting. We took the new ball. Wacker had bowled unbelievably all season. He was a little bit. Sorry, we didn't take the new ball. I brought him back for a spell. And Ronnie Irani, first ball, just went bang, hit him straight back over his head. I thought, this could be brilliant for us, this. Next ball, his middle stump was cartwheeling out the ground. And then he got Paul Grayson out, who's got 90 odd, just shortly after LBW. And so that was a game changer for us, because if he'd just milked Wacker at that stage, you know, because he bowled so much for us, he would have still given it, but it that just fired him up. That was, come on then. So yeah, that was a real good turning point, and which allowed us to be chasing a 180 rather than a 250, which would have been a different kettle of fish. So yeah, you play the situation, and I guess when things are clear, we knew that we needed to beat Essex, we knew that we needed to beat Somerset. The picture is very clear. You know, you just know what you had to do, and you know, Hugh had batted unbelievable again against Somerset. Hugh got 160. Hugh got 160 in that game, batted, you know, terrifically, which was, well, it wasn't his final, obviously, innings, because he still had to go out to knock 11 off at the end of day three. But yeah, we just got a great partnership going. It was just ball and react, you know. There was no, where's the ball? Bang, just clear of mind, clear of thought. Michael Vaughan has talked previously about being in the bubble, about having no noise around you, no interference. And that interference quite often comes from yourself. You know, as a player, if you might doubt, oh, as my head is of this, or you're overcomplicating the game and overthinking it and stuff like this. So, and that was both those innings, I guess, were the similarity between the two was I was in the bubble, in the zone. In the zone just to get the job done, if you like.
And not a single in that 100
I
at
didn't know, yeah, I didn't know that. Andrew Hignall told me that, I think, some years later, but yeah, I was not aware of that at the time. As I say, you just like you're just focused on, yeah, on just playing, and it's just, yeah, quite bizarre that really, isn't it? You know, that was, I think, after getting to the 100, I inside edge one down to fine leg, and that was the first single. It's crazy.
And a fabulous day, a fabulous celebration at the end of that season, and the achievement, the third county
Yeah.
championship for Glamorgan.
Yeah, because it was, you know, we had been kind of, I guess, building, you know, this team, this 13, 14, 15 players who are going to be part of it. Yeah, to win it there, to win it in the style, I guess, we did with, you know, Darren Thomas taking the fifer in the second innings, playing a massive part, getting key wickets of Lathwell, Bowler, you know, out. Bowler, unbelievable spell. That it was not the, I mean, Watty still played his part, don't get me wrong, as did Wackar, as did Crofty, and as did Dean Kosker. But Darren was the guy who broke their second innings open, really. And it was great that a younger seamer, our youngest seamer, was the one to do that, you know? And our young spinner was the one to take the final wicket, indeed, Costa. So that was pleasing, you know, but very, very pleasing.
A colleague of mine at the museum reminded me that you played in two county championship games at Cheltenham, 1991 and 2002. You
Yeah.
scored 100 in each of the innings in both those matches. Do
Yeah.
you remember the ground? And well, you must have fond memories of it.
Yeah, and both totally different surfaces, both totally different games. The first one, I think we may have got stuck in, and there was like the bits of water had come, had run down because we had obviously had rain before and gone under the covers. So there were lines of this the water coming, and they had an Aussie seat. I can't remember. Was it Terry Alderman played for them? I can't remember in '91, but they
Okay.
had this smiling Aussie bowling who just didn't miss a spot. And then
That
it
sounds
went,
like Terry Alderman.
yeah, it, yeah, yeah. But I remember the surface, and yeah, we got through it. And then if it hit the it would fly through. So, big Sid Lawrence was, I think, steaming in as well. So, but yeah, totally different. And the last one was spinning and stuff. But yeah, the fond memories of the guy, beautiful place to play, relax, kind of. You know, very friendly people of Gloucester's, Gloucester supporters, Montpellier Wine Bar Marquee, who would pop down there and have some dinner of an evening to the Montpellier Wine Bar. And it was just a very relaxed kind of place. And things like that to me are incredibly important. So the night before we had the final at Lord's, we were staying in the hotel just by the ground at Lord's. So we're staying there, but also are loads of committee and supporters, and they're all milling around, all talking, all the best for tomorrow, all of that. I couldn't take it. I had to get out. So I went down in to a pub that I know called A Bunch of Grapes, just to get away for an hour and a half. Just went there, had a couple of pints with a couple of mates who were obviously up for the game. But there was no talk about the final. It was just nice and relaxed. Went back to the hotel, went straight to my room. And speaking to the couple of the players afterwards, they all said they wish they'd done the same as me, gotten out of there, because all the well-meaning supporters and this, that, and all it was doing was filling their heads. And quite a number of them couldn't sleep that night. Thinking about the game and what it meant to people, obviously, and it had an effect on them that they didn't think, it was our first final for since 77. Or even though 93 was a kind of final, because it was first versus second at Canterbury, this was actually at the home of cricket. And it was a I like yeah I like being I mean people talk that I like to get out of places, and that was a pride. That was a great example of that, rather than being around everyone talking about the game and stuff. No, let me. I've done all my prep for the game. I've had my nets. I've done all my prep. I know where I am with my game. I just need to chill, And I don't think enough of our players relaxed enough that night beforehand.
Lovely statistic again, which no one can ever take away from you. First player in the first class game to score 100 in a semi-final and a final of a one-day competition.
In the same year, Again, that I guess as the picture becomes clearer, I became a better player, really, in certain aspects. But what I did, what I did, always thought I knew that was also going to be my last year as captain, because 5 years it can be, you take more and more on. As I talked about, Fletcher was brilliant because he took everything off. Not every coach would take everything off, Not every coach would protect the captain and the team as much as Fletch did. John Derek was brilliant at it, but other coaches that were got in were not as good. So you end up taking more and more and more on, and so there was always a shelf life. As I believe there is a, I think as a coach you can continue if there's quite a bit of turnaround within the squad. Otherwise, it's shelf life if you're working with the same players day in, day out, because they've heard everything you've got. So 5 years was about right. So I knew that was the last time I'd skipper the side, or last season I'd skipper the side. So just gave it all and gave it our best. It just wasn't quite to be. We were against a very strong. Obviously, Gloucester side at the time, they were very strong.
Coaching, was that a natural development that came through your career and kind of development of captaincy? And had you always thought you might be a coach? How did that?
Again, it's just a passion for the game. I was player coach in New Zealand for Otago, which was very, I found that very tough, if I'm honest. And that wasn't a great experience. Because I just forgot about my game and concentrated on everyone else's, and it's not, so my game kind of, I didn't do as well as I'd wanted to as a player. But I've always kind of helped play or tried to help players if I could, if I had something to do. And then Fletch obviously came along, and the one big thing that he talked about was if he doesn't have three reasons to adapt or change something within a player, then he won't. It's not strong enough. If he can't come up with three reasons to why it'd be a good reason to do this or that, then kind of why change? And it was a philosophy that I've kind of also followed in coaching, that you've got to be 100% sure of why you're making this adaptation for this player. And again, it was one of those, if you can give them three reasons, they're more likely to buy into it as well, or at least three reasons. Whereas if you say, oh, like, I think you should do this because of A, it's not substantial enough. So it has to be really to get them to think to. So, like with Andrew Strauss, with playing the Shane Warne, just looking to narrowing his angles down. Because he just wanted to play him either back up the ground or on the leg side. And they both said, you've got to stay leg side of the ball, open the offside up. And we went up to Old Trafford after he tried to kick down one away at Edgbaston. And he went round his legs. So, like, come on in. But, so, he, to be fair, we went up a day early with the lads from Merlin. And he practiced and practiced and he got it and he scored 100 in that test and obviously 100 in the last test. I mean, brilliant. Straussie that he thought, okay, I do have to try and find something now. And he did, and he was brilliant, but only when he was ready to, which was again the sign of a very clear-minded pro that he doesn't want to tinker for the sake of it, but he's got to be. We are trying to say as left-handers generally, you should be looking to hit Warnie through the offside so your shape stays good. Because he didn't really bowl a. Anyway, that's different. So the answer to the question is yes. And so prior to the 04 season, sorry, 05 season, so the winter of 03, 04, 02, 03, 01, 02, I've been working for. John Moore at Thomas Carroll Insurance Brokers in Caerphilly. And although John was a great boss and they had a great team of people there, it wasn't, it kept me driving to carry on playing cricket, because I didn't want to do that insurance job for the rest of my life. So the winter then of, I went and did some coaching with Fletch. He asked me, so that 04, 05 winter, went to Zimbabwe and South Africa as assistant coach. Loved it. Absolutely loved it. I had a wonderful, and then I came back to De Morgan and I had this net and I didn't feel anything. And I'd always had feedback to myself whether I had a good net or a bad net and I just felt flat. I thought, wait. But I'd found something that I loved just as much as batting and being part of a team that way. And I think that was it, that, well, you've found something now you can stop playing. And it was the last year of my contract anyway, but I picked up after the first game of the season, I actually picked up pneumonia that year. So I was out of action for 6 weeks anyway. And during my recovery, I got a call from John Carr at the ECB saying, Matt would like to offer you a full-time assistant role. Because I was just due to join them for the one-day series that year, have a month away from Glamorgan or 3 weeks away from playing, and then come back and finish the season and finish my career. But it wasn't to be. I ended up, being in bed and then being offered this job, and then so stuck with them for the 05 series, which was brilliant. Then obviously on to India and Pakistan then the following winter. So that was the kind of start of the coaching, and yeah.
Next week, you can join us for the final part of my chat with Matt, where he talks about his coaching philosophy, his England career, and his plans for the future. Matt is still completing his Wellyman walk for the Professional Cricketers Trust and Help for Heroes. You can donate by going to www.justgiving.com/campaign/Matt Wellyman walk or follow the link that will be in the notes to this episode. You can also help by spreading the word through your Facebook page or your X page. I hope you're looking forward to hearing the end of Matt's chat with us. If you are, then we'll see you next week, where we'll be hearing some more stories about the great game of cricket from the great country of Wales. Au revoir. Bye for now.
What are you doing? Oes gyda chi stori i'w rhannu gyda ni? Mae croeso i chi gysylltu. E-bostiwch mwcpod1921@gmail.com neu ewch i'n tudalen Facebook, Museum of Welsh Cricket Podcast, neu i'n tudalen Twitter, @WelshCricketPod. Do you have a story you'd like to share with us? If so, please contact email mwcpod1921@gmail.com or go to our Facebook page, Museum of Welsh Cricket Podcast, or our Twitter, @WelshCricketPod.